Hello, I'm Goldie Sayers, Olympian and former javelin thrower.
And I'm Molly Hind, Paralympian and former swimmer.
And welcome back to The Insider, the UK Sports Institute podcast.
Thank you to everyone who's joined us for Series 3 so far and for your interaction with each episode.
We're going to continue exploring the wonderful world of the Paralympics by focusing on innovation, highlighting two UK Sports Institute projects that have made a huge impact in this space.
First up is Alison McPherson and Rebecca Shanahan, who are both performance innovation consultants at the UKSI.
We'll be talking about Prosthetica, a service set up by Alison and Rebecca to act as the central point of contact for practitioners and athletes who have challenges around residual limb health, function, socket, and hardware selection and provision.
Let's find out more. How are you?
Good, thanks, Ollie.
Good, thank you.
Okay, then let's jump into some questions. So first question is, what is Prosthetica?
Prosthetica is a diagnostic service, really, for an athlete that wears a prosthetic within the high-performance system. I think the reality of that, what it looks like in real life, is that Becca and I run a triage service where practitioners have got a single point of contact to come with any prosthetic-related questions, be that socket fit, liner technology, hardware, we're not the experts, but we've acquired a lot of knowledge over time, so we can signpost practitioners to the right expertise dependent on the problem. I guess we're experienced problem solvers working within innovation.
And you've touched on it a little bit there, Ali, but could you kind of tell us a little bit about the purpose of prosthetic care and kind of why you decided to set it up?
Yeah, I mean, why we set it up, it was in direct response to a challenge that a practitioner was having within a sport. She is a practitioner working in a sport with a high number of amputees that are multiple medal winning, identified risks herself around prosthetics being a potential barrier to those athletes fulfilling potential in Paris, but she had nowhere to go. She was trying across multiple directorates to find the right person, people, but was getting nowhere. So when it came on our radar, I guess innovation, we're used to working in kind of messy, chaotic, uncertain landscape, of which prosthetics is certainly one. So it was kind of a natural fit for us. So we were able to run with it because of that. It would be a shame for a sport not to fulfill their medal goals because of something that had been highlighted and there was nowhere to go to address the problem.
And where did you kind of start with trying to set up a kind of system-wide performance enhancing service like this? Where do you start in trying to solve this kind of problem?
Well, we went to the source. So where this problem originated, and Ali's talked about it coming from paracanoe, we knew that if it was happening in one sport, it was likely to be happening across the system. So the big part of this is getting some really decent insight and starting to really sort of converge, really, and sort of open out, get as much information as we could across sports, athletes, practitioners, and start to build a picture of what we're actually dealing with. So you kind of end up as, and again, Ali sort of mentioned, in this kind of messy space where, you know, the more insight you get, the more complicated it sort of seems. But you start to sort of get a picture of the landscape. And, you know, we spent a good sort of 6 months on the ground, really speaking to athletes and practitioners and coaches and really understanding what their world was like before we could start to try and sort of figure out what sort of path forward might look like and how we might start to try and solve some of the problems.
And what were the issues on the ground with paracanoe that you were seeing? Obviously, somebody like myself, I would have no idea what issues you might have with a limb, for example, in a canoe.
Quite a lot. What it tends to manifest is skin breakdown, and also reports of sort of limbs that don't fit properly, or perhaps the prosthetic that they've got isn't designed exactly for the function that they need. So you might have a limb that's great for day-to-day use, but actually, does it perform in a canoe? Does it connect? Does it, you know, as one example, in the most optimal way?
I was going to say it's probably, you know, there's a challenge across the system between athletes that access their prosthetics through the NHS and those that access prosthetics through private practice. And since COVID, actually, the NHS provision has really struggled to kind of keep up with the demand of our high intensity user group. And when we undertook the problem, we had no sense of how many of our athletes are NHS prosthetics versus those that are in private practice. And I think the biggest difference around private practice is that clinicians are able to turn around prosthetics very quickly. And we had an instance in paracanoe where actually an athlete had waited 8 months from initial socket fit to getting a solution. And that's just simply too long. They missed an entire winter. And actually, they came back to us with an acute injury issue. And we were able to get an appointment with a clinician and get a solution within 2 weeks. So, you know, that's what we're able to do with prosthetic care. You know, our network is such that we are fast responders to challenges. And because we were able to do that, the athlete was able to have land-based training when they were off the water, which preserved all their aerobic fitness. So they went back in the boat in a better position than they would have had they still been under NHS provision.
Wow. So other than that, kind of what impact has this service had on athletes that you've experienced?
It's just been reassuring. It's actually, I think, more reassuring for the practitioner that they are actually leaving no stone unturned in the quest to Paris, because they identified a challenge. They didn't know where to go with it. And now they have good relationships with experts that, you know, that relationship is now established. And Paracanoe undertake prosthetic screening annually now as part of their medical athlete screening. They're actually having a pre-Paris MOT with our prosthetics. So they have that assurance that actually they couldn't have done any more around prosthetics being a cause of perhaps an issue in Paris. So I think it's just provided reassurance more than anything that the system is now responding to a need that I think we've always known has been there, but we've never had any evidence to say what scale of a problem we're dealing with.
I think I've added to that as well. I mean, but the work in Paracanoe's really opened up how they're looking at the amputee population, and they've brought in screening now that's specific to that, which they didn't have before. And there's kind of been a bit of a sort of push and pull, really, because their practitioners are now spending more time with the prosthetists, and there's learning and knowledge development on that side as well. You know, so it's all evolving and progressing, as you would hope.
I think one of the biggest challenges we've had before is that athletes are the sole owners of their prosthetic, in the sense that they would be the ones that go to their prosthetist. But actually, what the prosthetist thinks potentially is right for them might be at odds with what the coach's ambition is for that athlete. So we've actually been able to facilitate a multidisciplinary team approach to that prosthetic provision within Paracanoe, which has added significant value so that everyone is genuinely going in the same direction in terms of equipment and adaptations. That's been hugely beneficial, I think.
What are your kind of future ambitions with prosthetic care beyond Paris 2024? Where do you see that moving in the future?
I mean, we set ourselves an aspiration for Paris, which was, you know, we started this journey. It was quick wins. It was, you know, this easy point of contact for our practitioners. And we're really establishing and refining that process at the moment. And, you know, a lot's been achieved with really quite sort of simple input, really. So going forward, and think, you know, we're still designing. And I think this is the thing about designing in ambiguity, that you're constantly learning. And the ambition going forward would be to keep building, keep learning, keep co-designing with our athletes and with our sports, and keep monitoring what's happening and the effect of the things that we're doing. You know, what impact do they have, and where do we move from there? So we haven't started with knowing what the final solution is going to be. We're learning and we're designing as we grow. So I suppose building something that is sustainable and is world leading is the ultimate aspiration, you know, and giving that back to our elite athletes. But also, you know, what can we do that goes back into the general population as well? I mean, yeah, it's really, really aspirational for us as well.
Yeah, I think by understanding a few more about the challenges that are actually coming out from our athlete population, we can begin to kind of prime the academic researchers, you know, help them sort of target and focus their research into areas that will actually translate into having an application in performance. Quite often academic institutions do great research, but actually it's not directly relatable to our world. So if we can kind of go to research groups with problems and challenges we face, the likelihood is that research will be much more applied and actually have an impact in our population, which is what we want.
Why is a service like prosthetic care so important for both the athletes and the sports in a general sense as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, we said like trust and athletes knowing that they're in the right place and the service that they're accessing is bespoke for them and for their world and their environment is really important. And we started this with just trying to make life easy. And that single point of contact, you know, is so important when, you know, you're a practitioner in a sport and you've got a million and one things going on, you know, exactly where you can go to. So, you know, I wouldn't underestimate the value and the importance in that. I think the other thing with this is just, for what we've seen over the years that we've worked in this area, that sometimes is an acceptance of, you know, skin breaking down or something not being quite right. And these athletes just keep going, you know, they just accept it and they'll get on with it, or they don't report it because they just think, well, that's normal. There's nothing I can do about it. And we believe that they don't have to carry the burden of that. You know, there are things that we can do. And there's a gap here that we need to try and fill. That those are the sort of basics. And then you start to get into the sort of performance realm as well. And you start to get into like, what can we really focus on that's going to be really performance affecting? So yeah, that's why I think it's super important.
But I think it's really interesting, obviously, from my background, obviously in swimming, it's quite unique in that you use what you've got. But I'm really good friends with Charlotte Henshaw, obviously spent a lot of time training with Charlotte. So I know kind of the intricacies that go into her prosthetics, and looking at it from an athlete's perspective, I can imagine, especially at the games, you know, when you're in the greatest of pressures and obviously you're looking to bring that best performance that you can, ticking those things off, those 1%, knowing that you're kind of, yeah, like you say, world leading in that area of your performance. For me as an athlete, I could see that being, you know, massively reassuring.
It's quite interesting because I guess historically we would have always have looked at an athlete who wears a prosthetic in competition as being kind of our focus. But actually, one of the biggest, I guess, is causes of time lost in training could well be the poorly fitting day leg. So actually just starting to look at an athlete more widely as a human being who functions in daily life, you know, it actually has a performance impact, and it's just expanding the horizon in which we operate.
It is interesting, actually, having trained with a couple of sprinters with prosthetics, people wouldn't know that there were day legs. It's not like a day leg and a night leg, but a day leg and a performance leg. I mean, I didn't know until I started training with those guys. And yeah, just constant kind of maintenance in a few issues and, you know, on a daily basis, it's, you know, it's a lot to manage that. And then obviously having to run close to 10 seconds in a sprint as well is not bad either. But looking at innovation more broadly within high performance sport, what are the different kind of considerations that you have to bear in mind when working in the Paralympic space, perhaps compared with the Olympic space?
I mean, I think historically kind of we have an N equals one situation in the para sports. It's very rare we're able to undertake a program of work that would be rolled out, say, a new bike design across the entire system, because actually the complexities of individual impairments mean you have to really focus that connection and that athlete interface between that specific athlete and their equipment is very rarely generic. And I think often kind of innovation in the para space is new and novel in the context. You know, it might not be cutting edge innovation, but actually for that sport, that athlete, it is innovation because it's something new that they haven't tried before. I always think of it as being perhaps not revolutionary, but evolutionary. So it's kind of, it's not really new, but it is something that is evolving and being new and having the impact in the para sports.
I think that with the N equals one as well, we tend to see that first in Paralympic sport, and then things that we maybe work on grow into the bigger squad or sport, or even transfers over to other sports, things that we learn. Whereas on the Olympic side, we can see a lot of things that maybe are more squad based, and then it hones down to the individual. So it's almost inverse in some ways. But I think one thing I was thinking about this, and on the para side and Olympic side, you're always wanting to understand the user and, you know, the needs of that human being. And so in some ways it's the same. You know, you don't go in with assumptions and speak to people, ask questions, spend time with them on the ground. Yes, there are going to be some things that are going to be quite different from what you might have experienced on the able-bodied side. But ultimately, I think the process around it and how you understand the needs of someone is the same.
So I can hear the passion that you both have for Paralympic sport, but what do the Paralympics mean to you personally?
For me personally, it's an opportunity for athletes to defy the limits genuinely of what many may seem possible. It makes the impossible possible, hugely signifies hope, and acts as a catalyst for positive change across society. It changes perception. The aspiration for me is for the innovations that happen in the Paralympic arena transform the lives of people that are living with impairment day to day, be that the adoption of new technology or simply showcasing the absolute best of human endeavour.
Yeah, Ali's stolen my human endeavor line. That's but yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by human endeavor and the human spirit. And I think with the Paralympics and the para athletes, that's just supercharged. You know, you see it in clear clarity, really, and the stories are so inspirational, and just hope, and anything's possible, you know, never give up. I think that's what I always think when I work with these guys, and Ali would testify to this as well, working on the Paralympic movement, anyone you work with generally are so passionate about it, and there's something, you know, it's contagious.
Never give up, a fantastic last line. I'm really excited to see what might kind of be developed with you guys and brought into the general kind of population, because I think that's really quite inspiring for me, certainly.
So massive thank you to both Alison and Rebecca for joining us. I really enjoyed that. I found that really, really interesting. I'm sure that our listeners will too. And yeah, I would echo what Goldie said. We will look forward to seeing how prosthetic care continues to develop and the impact that it has on the system in the future. So thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're now joined by Steve Cooper, strength and conditioning coach at the UKSI, to discuss his innovative work in the cerebral palsy space. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
My pleasure.
Well, we're going to jump straight into some questions, Steve. Could you start by telling us about the project you undertook in the cerebral palsy space?
So I work across three different sports in the UKSI, wheelchair basketball, para badminton, and para table tennis. And so, yeah, three different Paralympic sports. So across that, I work with lots of different athletes, lots of different impairments. But the one kind of consistent thread across all three is our athletes with CP. And across the years that I've worked with these guys, they, and if you talk to my colleagues across the system as well, they are generally some of the hardest work athletes to work with, just because of the complex nature of the impairment and how varied it can be. Kind of the project that we went for was trying to understand that in a little bit more depth. So there is some research that exists out there in individuals with CP. There's very, very little in athletes with CP. So a lot of what we have to do is take research that's done on children or sedentary adults and try and apply that to athletes that are training full-time 10, 15, 20 hours a week, and assume that some of those things will carry across, when we know in reality that's unlikely to be the case. The idea here was to try and take some of the things we thought we know and apply it to some of these athletes and see whether we were right or wrong. And there's always lots of more learnings we could do. It was only a very small kind of pilot study. We took three athletes from across two of the sports here that I work with. We purposely took athletes that had hemiplegic CP. So that's one side affected. That's not to say the other side is completely unaffected, because it's obviously a brain injury, but they will have one side that's predominantly affected. So it almost gave us within themselves a little bit of a control, and we could generate some comparison between the side that was more affected by CP and the side that's not particularly affected or not as affected as much, and kind of compare the sides and see where the differences lie.
Awesome. And I understand you did this on top of your day job as well. So what was kind of the motivation behind this project?
I guess it's just a bit of a curiosity, I suppose. Like I said, working across this athlete kind of cohort across all the sports, it was the challenge of, I don't really understand this. And I'm the sort of personality that I don't really like something I don't understand. And I find it's harder to do my day job as a result of this kind of lack of understanding. And it's not just me, it's a wider system problem. But it's, yeah, just to look at it and go, if I could work with a little bit more certainty, or these are the things maybe I'm assuming about these athletes and I'd like to understand them in more depth. So it was there. I guess it was a curiosity, and I think for me that's a lot of the joy of working in Paralympic sport, is there isn't a textbook, there isn't this is the obvious answer to this problem. If you work with a footballer, this is the stock program you should do. And if you're working with Paralympic athletes, you get almost a chance to write that book yourself as you go. And that's quite a fun place to be. And I guess this was just another part of that sort of process.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think from my experience, Steve, obviously working in my career in Paralympic swimming, I think it's quite a common theme for strength and conditioning coaches to be, you know, almost inspired by the nature of every athlete is bespoke, and that problem solving aspect of things. So I think it must be a common trait across strength and conditioning coaches in that kind of para space.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just a bit more fun. You get the challenge of doing new things day in, day out. And my athletes know as well as anyone else that every now and then I'll come in with a really silly idea and go, I wonder if this might work. And it's just a chance to try something. Like I say, because you're not working off the textbook, you get a chance to go, what about this, and that, this, that, and the other. Whereas normally you'd want to be the person at the front of the room that's got all the right ideas and knows the right thing. And this is the right program. I think sometimes the fun of Paralympic sport is you might go into the gym with, I've not got the program, but I've got these four ideas. And I think at least one of them is going to work. And then you and the athlete together will kind of co-create the program and work on it as a group, because you don't know how they feel, but they don't have the skill sets and the knowledge that you have. And it's kind of that collaboration between you and the athlete that allows that to something more interesting and something kind of that fits the needs of that athlete to come out the other side.
And I think that's what makes a great practitioner, is someone who will admit we don't know everything. And we don't know so little really about the human body in many ways, and then add the layer of CP onto that. But I'm interested, what were your learnings about the kind of muscular kind of architecture of a CP athlete, and maybe how that then transferred into other areas that you're perhaps working in?
CP is essentially a brain injury that often occurs around birth or just after birth. And the difference between CP and a stroke, for example, is that an individual CP has, because it happens so close to birth, will grow up with that brain injury, and therefore their body develops in a certain way. The challenge essentially is there is a break in communication at some extent between their brain and their muscles. So if you think about it from an athletic point of view, the signal they send to that bit doesn't necessarily get through. Sometimes if you ask them to move their left hand, their right hand will just join in. For no good reason, essentially because sometimes the kind of wires get a bit crossed, I guess is probably the easiest way to describe it. That has an effect at the brain, and like I say, the signal's getting through, but as that happens over a long period of time, the body then develops in a certain way. So some of the things we know from previous bits of research, like I say, in children and other adults, that was probably confirmed to a certain extent through the research we did here, was that individuals with CP, or the areas of the body that are affected with CP, generally the muscles are smaller, they're shorter, and they kind of composed of slightly different fiber types. And they're also set up at slightly different angles. It's something called pronation angle, which we definitely need to go all the way into, but the greater a pronation angle, generally the greater brute force a muscle can produce. And that tends to be less with these athletes with CP. And so some of these things we were kind of confirmed in the athletes we worked and we put through this pilot study, which was good. So obviously that helps us to look at back at previous research and go, okay, there's probably some evidence in that that we can use and carry across. But all of those things together generally mean that a muscle can't produce as much force, and it can't produce as much force quickly. And especially if you speak to any S&C coaches work with an athlete with CP, they'll generally tell you that there's almost like a beat between them thinking about doing something and the thing happening. And it's that sometimes it's been that kind of coordination where they get the challenges. So that's all of those things were kind of confirmed by what we were looking at, which was really helpful. Really helpful to see the kind of the extent of difference between the some left and right side, and some of these guys where we've got the hemiplegics, and we've got left and right kind of comparisons. But I guess it was really helpful that a lot of those things confirmed. There's a lot more research that could be done, and a lot wider research could be done. And there's definitely some interest in, we purposely looked at quads and hamstrings, because it tends to be that the muscles either side of the joint are affected in the way they work, and obviously they're codependent on each other to work, but it tends to be that muscles on one side tend to be more affected than the other. So again, we're just trying to look at it fairly broadly. It was very exploratory kind of pilot studies, go, what exists here, what can we confirm? And I think it'll be something that hopefully going into next cycle we may well be able to roll out to a wider group of athletes across the system, to have a look at, does this apply across a greater breadth of athletes, but also to say, this is what we know, can a training intervention change this? And I think that's probably the next stage where we'd like to go with it, is probably, like I say, we'll probably confirm some things we probably thought already, but we've got athletes here that are going through extensive training programs on a regular basis. Do these things change over time? Because all we've got at the moment is one kind of snapshot, and I think that's probably the key to working out the success from this and the impact across the system, is to what extent can we change some of these things, and what does that mean for performance for these guys?
Yeah, and I suppose you've touched on it there a little bit, but you know, how did you implement the learnings that you found in your research, and kind of what impact have you noticed that you've been able to have on some of the CP athletes that you're working with?
If we look at, we look at some of the things we talked about there. So if we know there's a challenge between brain signal and muscle action, okay, if we want to look at training an athlete to get stronger, how can we help to kind of shortcut that system? So we use muscle stimulation with some of the athletes, for example, where we'll apply a complex or other systems are available to the muscle to help kind of boost the brain signal that will be going to that muscle. So we help to kind of circumvent some of the challenges. You think about a muscle that's shorter, we'll purposely put in strength training exercises that look at developing that muscle through a full range of motion. And we've seen some really good benefits from that with some of the athletes around increasing range, increasing function, and therefore increasing performance in their sporting environment. So there's some of those actions, or if you think about a muscle that's just smaller and we saw kind of less muscle thickness within those muscles, it may well be that your training program, instead of being focused purely on strength, you maybe go after muscle size as more of a priority. And it's just starting to decode and pick apart some of these things we know about these athletes, and therefore what does that mean for their training, and how do we fit that then into a longer kind of year plan or a longer term plan through to a games. So there's probably lots of little wins we've had within that with some of the athletes as we've started to apply these projects over time. But it's just taking that kind of logical step, and so that, again, that's where we see the research go that step further. But it's taking that logical step from this is what we know at the moment of works in an able body population, and this is what we're applying and seeing, this is the results we're seeing. And then, like I say, to potentially look at that across a bigger group of athletes across a longer period of time.
So I guess with the athletes with CP, do you find there needs to be an emphasis on their program, you know, around like joint health and, you know, that kind of injury prevention work in the gym? Do you think that's a lot more prevalent maybe than in some of like the able-bodied athletes that don't have that kind of neurological impairment?
I think the space between performance enhancement and injury prevention is probably a lot shorter in some of these athletes. So you think about an able-bodied athletes program, you might have certain things this is for performance and this is for injury prevention. I know those things do have a lot of crossover, but probably in the Paralympic space, those things probably sit a lot closer to each other. Often you have the general kind of aim of looking at improving function in some way. So every athlete that's a Paralympic athlete is there because of some physical or often physical impairment. Obviously there's definitely, if you're intellectually impaired or visually impaired, but obviously a lot of them sit in this kind of physically impaired group. They're all there because of some form of physical impairment, and therefore that gives you straight away something you can help them to try and work on or around or with to see some improvement. And sometimes those things will then sit in the middle of, this is injury prevention, this is also performance enhancement, this is also supporting your day-to-day living. And I think that's often the part that becomes additional in this Paralympic cohort that you might not get in an able-bodied athlete, is like occasionally I'll put exercise into athletes' programs that are just about helping them get through day-to-day, because if all of a sudden we can support something else in their day-to-day life that means that they're spending less energy getting around and they can conserve more energy for their sports training, then that's performance enhancement in itself. So it's sometimes just having that slightly different lens on how it all kind of fits together and what an exercise kind of aims to produce.
What's an example of one of those exercises, Steve? Sorry, I'm just intrigued.
Take one of my Paralympic table tennis players. So if you take an athlete that's playing table tennis in a wheelchair, for example, you don't need massive amount of strength to, like, the ball weighs a number, like a few grams, right? You don't need to be really, really strong to hit that ball hard, especially if you're sat down, a lot of that force is going to come from your trunk. So having really strong arms and shoulders, for example, probably doesn't help you that much for table tennis. But when you consider the position they'll often find themselves in, the fact they need to transfer in and out of their chair day in, day out, getting in and out of bed, getting on off the toilet, all those sort of things are going to require them to push pretty heavily with their arms to do that. Yes, you might not want to put arm strengthening training work in there for the sake of table tennis, but you probably would put it in there for the sake of maintaining their shoulder health for day-to-day living or helping them to transfer more easily. So it's all those sort of things that you think about. That's probably just generic kind of strength training, but being just more generally strong for these guys can be really helpful just to, like I say, to manage the day-to-day.
Your work in this space, I believe, was recognised by UKSI recently, who presented you with the Innovation Award at their last staff conference. How did you feel? I'm sure you were very proud to receive that. So, yeah, how did you feel?
Yeah, it was obviously really nice. Really nice to be kind of recognised. I guess you don't really do it for the awards and those sorts of things. You do it because it's something you're passionate about or something you're interested in, or because it's your job. I must admit, I've been teased mercilessly by my various friends and colleagues in the institute. One of my colleagues thought it'd be a funny idea to put a little poster up on the door of the gym that said Steve Cooper's Innovation Laboratory that sat there for a number of months. But yeah, there's been lots of friendly banter about it, and lots of it was nice. It was nice. Like I say, it's nice to be recognised. It's nice to have an opportunity to see some of the work you do kind of get picked up in that from that point of view.
And I guess kind of taking that a step further, what are your future ambitions and goals kind of within the Paralympic space?
I guess when I got into Paralympic S&C six, 7 years ago, I picked up the job because it was a job in the institute and I wanted to work in the institute, not because I wanted to work in Paralympic sport. And ever since then, I kind of fell in love with it, really. And I really enjoy working kind of in this sphere. So, and I certainly wouldn't want to step out of it anytime soon. So I think for me, it's just to continue to kind of push on in this direction, really. Like I said earlier, I really enjoy the idea of how can we be creative? How can we kind of think about new ways of working with these athletes and support people in doing things that they never maybe thought they could do or no one else thought they could do? And I think there's a real, it's just something in there that's just that's really fun and really inspiring to work amongst. So for me, I think to stay within this area and continue to work through solving the problems that are kind of presented to us and maybe in the future I'd love to maybe take some of the learnings from the last few years and try and maybe share those more widely across the Institute or more widely than that. I've done a few lectures at universities and those sort of things, which has been really interesting to kind of look at students that are coming through, getting an opportunity to learn about some of these things that I was never given as a student. So I think that for me is the opportunity to go and talk to aspiring S&C coaches that maybe had the same thought process that I had, that never really thought about working in Paralympic sport, and go, maybe you should and maybe you could, and here's why. Because there's lots to learn and lots of fun to be had and lots of development for practitioners within it as well. So yeah, I guess I've got a bit of a bug for it, got a bit of passion for it. And I think it's I'd love to stick around doing it.
And just to finish with Steve, what do the Paralympics, or looking ahead to this summer, what do the Paralympic Games mean to you?
Well, I think about the Paralympics, what's the Paralympics? It's just another sporting event. It's just it's a really cool sporting event to go home and watch and get involved in and engage with. Yes, there's, from looking at it from the outside as an able-bodied person, there is things amongst it that are very inspiring. But having worked with these athletes, you see, it's their chance to have a go, right? It's their chance to compete at the highest level, to show what they can do, and be able to do that on a level playing field that allows them to showcase their kind of skills and their work, their hard work and talent. And so I guess for me, it's just another sporting occasion. It's just a slightly different angle on another sporting occasion. And it's really cool to see people get the opportunity to do that and showcase what they can do.
Ollie, did you feel that when you were taking to the blocks? Was it just another day at the office for you, the Paralympics?
To be honest, Goldie, I think the first time around I was quite relaxed, but second time around I was definitely a lot more nervous. But no, I love what Steve just said there. I think it's, yeah, that's what the Paralympics is about. Obviously, there is that kind of inspiration, motivation side of things, you know, overcoming those adversities and challenges. But you know, at the end of the day, it's elite sport, isn't it? And yeah, really looking forward to this summer to see some more elite sport.
Fantastic. So a huge thanks to Stephen for joining us to talk about the impact of his work in the cerebral palsy space.
If you want to learn more about the UK Sports Institute or Paralympics GB, follow them on socials via @UKSportsInst or @ParalympicsGB.
Up next on The Insider, we'll be talking about mental health.
Follow the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Leave a review, or if you're listening on Spotify, share your thoughts in the poll. Or you can always chat more to us on social media.
Until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll catch up soon.